Yep. And basically, we talked about the Tanayim, which are the scholars of the Mishnah, to be followed by the Amoraim, which literally means the interpreters, which are the scholars that are mentioned in the Talmud. And that takes us to approximately the year 600, the 7th century of the Common Era. And by that time, because of the rise of the Byzantine Empire and the rise of Christian persecution, there is basically no halachic community in the land of Israel at all. And that is why the Babylonian Talmud continued for several hundred years past the terminus date of the Jerusalem Talmud. And basically, we now begin a new period which lasts for approximately 500 years. And this is a period which is actually shrouded in somewhat of an obscurity, although in recent years we have a greater sense of what's going on. And that is the period that is known as the period of the Gaonim. Now the term Gaon, what is the term Gaon? Gaon is a biblical term actually, meaning excellence or distinction. Right? For example, there's a phrase Gaon Yaakov, which is taken from the Bible, talking about the glory of Jacob. But Gaon became the honor, title of honor that was given to the heads of the Babylonian academies. Now, of course, the Babylonian academies were established by the Amoraim, we discussed last week, the Academy of Sura in southern Babylon, which would be southern Iraq, and originally the Academy of Naharda in the north that was destroyed and eventually replaced by the Great Academy of Pumbedita. So they were established in the days of the Amoraim, but they continued to function for the 500 years after the conclusion of the Talmud. And the heads of these yeshivot, the heads of these academies, were called Gaonim, His Excellency. It's kind of a title of royalty. And these two yeshivot, in Sura and Pumbedita, were considered to be the halachic authorities for the entire diaspora. In fact, what was very interesting is that institutionally, this achieved a measure of centralization and authority that really was unparalleled really from the time of the Sanhedrin itself. In other words, even during the time of the Amoraim, there was not such a centralization of authority. And thus, we find constantly the notion that the shtei yeshivot, now we have to understand that the word yeshiva has somewhat of a different meaning than we would use it today. Today, a yeshiva is a school where people come to study. Now, there too, people came to study in the yeshiva, but as a result, a student in the yeshiva had no particular say as to what halacha was. So you have to understand that when the Gaonim writes, it is the decision of the shtei yeshivot, that, it doesn't mean they took a poll of the student body. Then as now, students didn't count for very much, the exception, of course, with our group here. Really, it was also an assembly of the great rabbis of the generation. And at various times, the two yeshivot came to a consensus. Sometimes there was disagreement. At various times, the yeshiva of Sura was the dominant yeshiva. Other times, the yeshiva of Pumbedita was the dominant yeshiva. But the Gaonim, as it were, regarded the Talmud as definitive and unchangeable, meaning to say, they didn't add to the Talmud proper. The Gaon based all of their decisions on the Talmudic discussion. But what began during the 500 years of the Gaonim is what we might call a process of standardization and centralization. Because remember, the one outstanding characteristic of the Talmud is the presentation of diversity of views, exploration of process, and only very rarely coming to a final decision. Meaning to say, it is a total misconception to perceive of the Talmud as a book of law. In no possible sense does the Talmud give you, almost in any case, a definitive rule of decision to follow. The Talmud gives you a diversity of views. Now, that would mean, in effect, that having the Talmud alone, there essentially would be the tendency for decentralization, where each community, each rabbi, each leader, each congregation, based on the common authority of the Talmud, would then come to different halachic conclusions. And it might be very possible that with the same Talmud, some communities would follow practice X, and some communities would follow practice Y. Well, one of the functions of the Gaonim was to create a certain measure of standardization. Right? So in a negative sense, you could call it straitjacking. In a positive sense, we would call it uniformity. by having centralized bodies that will that would promulgate halachic determinations for the entire diaspora. The reason I mentioned diaspora was because, on all practical purposes, there was no Jewish community in the land of Israel. But the few Jews that were in Israel also regarded the Gaonim of Babel as having great authority. Now, the Gaonim were not political heads. There still was the office of Resh Galuta that was limping along. And we do find that there were much friction between various Gaonim and the Resh Galuta, because the Gaonim often tried to politically dictate things, as well as the opposite. The Resh Galuta sometimes tried to decide halachic matters. Occasionally you had a learned Resh Galuta. In a way, a learned Resh Galuta was even more of a headache, because the learned Resh Galuta tried to usurp, as it were, some of the halachic functions. Some of the Gaonim are very well known. Probably the most famous Gaon, remember this is a 500 year period, so it's a pretty long period, is Rav Sadia Gaon. By the way, there is a little bit of a tradition, although I don't know if it's historically verified, that the word Gaon, which means excellency, was a title of distinction, it actually is also based on a gematria, that the Gaon is Gimel, Aleph, that's 4, and Vav is 6, that's 10, and Nun is 50. The gematria of Gaon is 60. And there are approximately 60 tractates of the Mishnah and Talmud, and the idea was that the necessary condition to being appointed a Gaon was mastery of the tractates of the Mishnah. Of course, the Talmud, the Gemara is fewer than 60, but the entire Mishnah is 63 tractates. That was a tradition. Now, by the way, the term Gaon later became used in common parlance for very, very distinguished great rabbis. So even today, we might refer to a great, great halachic scholar as a Gaon. I say Rabbi Feinstein would be called Harav HaGaon. Okay, but those titles should not be thrown around indiscriminately as they sometimes are. However, keep in mind that that's a borrowed term, that Gaon actually referred to a very, very specific position. That was the head of the great academies of Surah and Pumbedita. There were regional yeshivot as well, but the leadership institutions were in those two yeshivot. Surah, you recall, had been founded by the great Amora Rav, and Pumbedita was the successor to the yeshiva of Nahardara that had been founded by his colleague Shmuel. Actually, Shmuel didn't found it, but Shmuel made it very prominent. Yeah.
When was the Masoretic?
Yeah, the Masoretic, that is a very interesting point. The Masoretic text actually does originate, it depends what you mean by the Masoretic text. I mean, halachic Jews believe that the Masoretic text was the authentic text that dated from the time of Jerusalem, but in terms of the formalized system of the shape of the vowels and the notes and the like, was actually the only product. It actually was a product of the land of Israel. And it dates from the end of the Talmudic era into the beginning of the Gaonic era. So it is true, that may be the very last product for several hundred years of Eretz Yisrael. The great Masoretic expert was Ben Asher, who had a whole family of people who were expert in grammar and biblical text, and they were in Tveria. So that was a product of the very late Amoraic and early Gaonic period. The Talmud itself records many kreis and ksivs and says that this is halacha l'moshe misinai. There are some problems there, because some of the things that the Talmud indicates about kreis and ksiv do not correspond to what is called our Masoretic text. So there are some divergencies, which raises a problem of how do you have discrepancies on something that is said to be a halacha l'moshe misinai. Remember, Maimonides laid down a rule that in the traditions that come down from Moshe, there should generally not be any disagreement. I mean, that's a difficulty. But the official, as it were, repository, again, just to be sure people are familiar with this, the Masora, which of course literally just means the handed down tradition, is used for a very specific component of the oral law, which is actually something that we haven't been talking about. And that is the various structural features of the biblical text. It's kind of the oral law regarding the biblical text itself. So for example, there are many, many characteristics in the biblical text that comprise what we call the Masoretic text. Among them is the creemptive, meaning certain words are written a certain way, but we pronounce them differently than they're written. So the way it's written, for example, there may be a word that's not even there. There may be a blank space, and you read it as if there's some word there, right? Or the opposite. So that's called cri. Certain words are read and not written. Certain words are written and not read. We have big letters and small letters. There are just listing of things. For example, Vayikra, in the beginning of Leviticus. The aleph at the end of Vayikra is a tiny aleph. It's small. And then we have for Shema, Yisrael, Hashem, Elokeinu, Hashem, Echad, the ayin and the dalid are enlarged, spelling the word ed. There are words that have dots over them. These are not vowels in the Sefer Torah itself. Right? So these are all sorts of structural features of what are called the Masoretic text. And also, there are words that have unusual spellings, etc. And a group of scholars called the Baalei Mesorah, the transmitters of Mesorah, kept very, very accurate records of all of these structures, including the Tamim. Tamim are the musical notations, and the Nekudot, and they developed a vowel system, because as you know, the Hebrew language itself, at least in its original form, does not have any vowels, it is only consonants. And you know, when you read, you know, even modern Hebrew today, you know, essentially, one reads without nekudot, right? Take a newspaper. But the Baalei Mesorah developed at least a system of vowels to indicate pronunciation and the like. And the truth is, there were different traditions of what the vowel symbols are. Our vowel symbols, you know, the komats and everything else, were only one system, a system of Ben Asher. There were alternative systems that were going around. We're not sure exactly how they pronounced it, because as you know, Hebrew pronunciation to this very day is not uniform. Besides the Ashkenaz and Sephard, you have all sorts of European variations, right? So for example, a Lithuanian Jew pronounces the word Torah as Teira. The O is an A. A Polish Jew pronounces it like O-Y, Teira. These are Hebrew pronunciations. In fact, a lot of the Yemenite pronunciations mirror Polish pronunciations. Very funny. I mean, it's not, you know, a Yemenite, which many regard as perhaps the most pristine Hebrew pronunciation, actually has some things that sound very much like the Hasidic Jew in Poland. So we don't know exactly how Hebrew is pronounced, and it's somewhat of a mystery. Certainly, Hebrew must have been pronounced very different than anyone pronounces it today, because we have so many letters in which our pronunciations are virtually indistinguishable. Ches and Achaf, at least for the standard Hebrew speaker, doesn't have much of a difference. The Aleph and the Ayin, which should have a difference. Ayin is a deeper guttural, with a little bit of a N sound. But you know, most of us don't really pronounce that correctly. The Tuf and the Tet, you know, so obviously wouldn't make sense to have an alphabet where, you know, 10 letters are just doubles of each other. So there's a whole pronunciation that perhaps we've lost, but the Baalei Mesorah did preserve the text very, very accurately. And in fact, if you look at a Masoretic Bible, which is very interesting to do, you'll all see all sorts of word lists. Like every unusual word, there's a notation that tells you how many times it appears and where it appears. And the abbreviations are very, very obscure. Actually, the best work on the Mesorah to decipher the abbreviations, which are really almost impossible, is actually done in Christian Bible colleges, because in yeshivas, the Mesorah is not studied at all. It is totally ignored. In the Christian Bible schools, they do a lot of study on the Mesorah, and the books that explain the abbreviations of the Mesorah, etc., tend to be actually written by mainly by non-Jews, but nevertheless, this was the last product of the either non-Jews or apostate Jews. I mean, the great Masoretic scholar of the 19th century was a fellow, Christian Ginsburg was his name, and Christian was not his name at birth, and he was basically a Jew who converted to Christianity, unfortunately. Yeah.
Okay. I was wondering, assuming that all the things have changed, but the top and the top,
yeah.
a very recent conscious change, why yeah. was that done?
Well, not really very recent, just a question of the, what's called the Ashkenaz pronunciation yeah. and the Sephardic pronunciation.
The Sephardic pronunciation is yeah. a th.
Is a th- is, that's with yes, that, that's correct.
And
that's
so
correct.
Both of those were eliminated.
Yes, more or less. That's correct. The so-called Sephardic pronunciation that we use in modern Hebrew is not authentically Sephardic either. It's just something Eliezer ben Yehuda liked, and you know, he pushed for it. It's hard to say. Part of it is that the revival of Hebrew as a modern spoken language, which is not that old. It's only less than 100 years old, and you had to deal in a way with the way people, you know, who had praying in Hebrew or speaking in Hebrew, just you had to kind of incorporate their pronunciations and fold them into the language. Just like, you know, those attempts at Esperanto or other universal languages usually fail because people are habituated a certain way. So the whole development of modern Hebrew was actually a bunch of concessions to the various styles that people had. Certain things were difficult. But the truth is, I mean, a lot of the Hebrew pronunciation is still, you still find it in Arabic. So in a way, Arabic probably sounds more like Hebrew than Hebrew does today. They still preserve a lot of the distinctive pronunciations that most of us find difficult. Yeah, but be it as it may, the most famous, by the way, I should also mention another thing that was going on during the period of the Gaonim, which was a very, very major issue, was the rise of the Karaite movement. Now, the Karaim, the word Karaim literally means students of the Bible. Mikra is the Bible. And the Karaites are not the same as the Sadducees of the Second Temple. The Sadducees were a particular movement that more or less died out. But their philosophical and religious premise was much the same, and that was the refusal to accept the authority of the oral law, and in particular the rejection of the Talmud as being the definitive exposition of God's Torah. And the argument was made that the only valid source of authority are the five books of Moses and the prophetic writings themselves. Now, as is true for a lot of these religious movements, the truth of the matter is, Karaism was invented by a fellow Anan, who simply did not want to accept some of the decisions of the Gaonim. Basically, he wanted to position himself, so it's kind of strange. If he would have been offered the Gaonit, he would have been a big supporter of the Talmud. Since he wasn't offered the job, he decided to reject the Talmud, and he developed a movement of Karaites. And one interesting thing that historians have speculated is that if the role of the Gaonim was standardization and uniformity, which one might argue in a sense is almost anti-Talmudic, because the Talmud itself, the whole premise is diversity of views and process, but it could be that the movement towards uniformity and standardization was a response to the dangers that were perceived in Karaite heresy. You see why? Because if the concept would be that you create a halachic system that's open, that's flexible, that has many, many different approaches, the Karaites just say, well, we're one of them too. You know, we're just another one of the approaches. So the Gaonim saw as necessary for the preservation of the authentic Jewish religion, they saw the need, as it were, to create a greater push towards standardization in order to clearly demarcate who's in and who's out, in the sense of the Karaites being outside of the fold. Nevertheless, as is true for the Sadducees as well, the Karaites, which, you know, there still are Karaites, by the way, they're not totally extinct, although there's an old tradition, there's a synagogue in Jerusalem, the Karaite synagogue, and but there's an old tradition, they'll never have a minyan. And I haven't verified this, but the story people tell is that they always have just 9 people. That whenever somebody converts to Karaitism, or they do get converts, somebody dies, etc. They never manage to get a complete minyan. But what's fascinating
maybe
is...
they don't need one. Maybe they've made the rule.
Well, that's true.
Well, that's
an interesting question.
Yes.
That's really the point I want to make. It is true that minyan itself is a law of the oral tradition.
Right.
And yet, the point is this. The Karaites really are not quite as literalist as you would imagine. Basically, they developed their own oral traditions. Because the truth of the matter is, every legal and religious system need some type of oral understanding of how you do things. And therefore, for the Karaites to say, we don't believe in the oral tradition, we only follow the written word, really did not turn out to be true. They simply made up their own and passed it down. So, for example, I once saw in the Harvard University library a Karaite Siddur. Now, what would you have in a Karaite Siddur? You would certainly have all the passages that are in our Siddur that are from the Tanakh. So you have the reading of the Shema, and you have the Tehillim and other Psalms as well. But there's no Amidah, because Amidah is a product of Rabbinic Judaism, and therefore there's no Amidah. But instead, they compose their own prayers. So, you know, they have prayers that are not in the Bible. They have their own scholars. Now, in truth of the matter is, the Gaonim had a very kind of, I don't want to call it a love-hate relationship, because it was really predominantly hate, but although the Karaites, you know, and the Gaonim had a very strong dislike for each other, I mean, because of the ideas, nevertheless, the Karaites do have a contribution that is regarded fairly highly in the Jewish tradition, and that is, because they did not devote their efforts to Talmud and Halakha, they did become very, very expert in biblical grammar and translation. And they wrote a number of books, and the great classical biblical commentaries that are within the main theme of Rabbinic Judaism do on occasion quote Karaite authors for the exposition of words. The Ibn Ezra, who lived shortly before Maimonides, often relies on Karaite authors for grammatical interpretations and the like. The Abarbanel, who is later, the Abarbanel is in the 15th century, often does so. So the Karaites were regarded as having skill. In fact, we even have some anti-Christian polemical works, which were authored by Karaites, although some of the later people who quoted them, some of the later rabbis were not aware of the Karaite origins. There's a famous book which has even been translated in English called Chizuk Emunah, which means the strengthening of faith, which is a very interesting book. It's a book that's dated, it's a late Karaite, a Karaite from the 1300s, who wrote a book going through all the biblical verses that Christians use to show that Jesus is being foretold, the verses from Isaiah, and this person goes through them by offering the understanding of the verses and shows how they've been distorted. Now, that has been a very Chizuk Emunah, has been a very influential work. It has figured very prominently in Jewish anti-Christian polemics. But the author of that work happens to have been a Karaite. Now, he doesn't wear it on his sleeve. In other words, the book is not designed to attack the Talmud. He just doesn't mention the Talmud. He just goes through biblical verses and shows how the Catholic Church, in particular, misinterpreted. So, even though the Karaites are more or less rejected Halachic Judaism, but nevertheless, they were highly regarded for that particular series of skills that they had, and that is primarily in biblical grammar. And say again, Karen? Chizuk Emunah, I believe, was written in the 14th century, in the 1300s. So this is after the Gaonim. In other words, this is post-Gaonim Karaites, but again, they are still successors of this movement. Just a few of the famous names of the Gaonim. The most famous Gaon is Rav Sadia Gaon. Rav Sadia Gaon actually was born in Egypt. He came to Iraq, came to Babylon in his 30s, and he eventually established himself as the greatest of the scholars. He wrote a number of works, most of which were in Arabic. He wrote his works in Arabic. Among them was considered to be the first systematic work on Jewish philosophy, not a halakhic work. And that is the Sefer Emunot V'Deot, which is translated as the Book of Beliefs and Opinions, in which he goes through various fundamentals of Jewish faith, such as the existence of God, resurrection, Moshiach, all of these ideas. Rav Sadia Gaon also wrote the first Arabic translation and commentary on the Bible, which in recent years has been translated into Hebrew. So he translates the Bible into Arabic, and then we translate the Arabic into Hebrew, but obviously you don't get back to the Tanakh. I mean, he translated it with his commentary and the like. And among Yemenite Jews, until that community was essentially destroyed, that was the standard book that was studied. The standard biblical commentary was the commentary of Rav Sadia Gaon. In fact, the rabbi who translated it into modern Hebrew, Rabbi Yosef Kapach, died recently. He was the head of the a very, very distinguished scholar. He was the head of the Yemenite community in Jerusalem. And he retranslated all the Rambam's Arabic works into modern Hebrew, and he also did the same with Rav Sadia Gaon. Rav Sadia Gaon himself had a very, very turbulent life. He was involved not only in struggles against Karaitism, but in fights with the Resh Galuza. He was threatened with being deposed and being arrested and all sorts of things. And somehow, in the middle of all this, he found time to compose these works and really establish a surah back to its point of glory, as it was in the days of the Amoraim Rav. Other Gaonim, just to mention some names, we have Rav Amram Gaon. Rav Amram Gaon is noted for putting together the first compilation of the Siddur, of all things. Now, the Talmud lays down the basic order of prayers, but the Talmud does not give you the word-for-word rendition of what the prayers are. Right? In other words, the Talmud assumes one of two things. Either the Talmud assumes we'll give you the structure, and every community did it themselves. For example, the Talmud will give you the order of the blessings of the Amidah, but does not give you the exact wording of those blessings. So one could either understand that was so well known that the Talmud didn't bother to do it, or the alternative would be that there was local autonomy that was recognized in the composition of the prayers. Rav Amram Gaon, again, not alone, but through his yeshiva, promulgated the order of the Siddur. So to this day, the basic structure of the Siddur and the basic wording of the Siddur is based on the Siddur of Rav Amram Gaon. Now, of course, keep in mind that the one area where the Gaonim were unable to fully standardize practice was in liturgy. Because in truth, even when the Gaonim promulgated the liturgy, those that had distinctive customs refused to surrender them. And in fact, it is said that what is commonly known as the Sephardic liturgy is derived from the Babylonian rite of Rav Amram Gaon, but what is commonly known as the Ashkenazic liturgy is derived from an older practice in the land of Israel, which was not superseded by the Gaonim. And, of course, there are many other rites as well. There's an Italian rite. In fact, there are certain rites that only three communities in Italy had, etc. There are many. Now, of course, what is notable is, though, that in spite of everything, there is a basic uniformity and familiarity. The truth of the matter is you can go into any synagogue in the world. It might be in a Yemenite synagogue, they'll be sitting on the ground or sitting on cushions or taking off their shoes. There might be, of course, there'll be unique and distinctive customs. But basically, you have your Shemona Esrei, you have your Amidah, you have your Shema, you have your blessings before and after. If one knows the Siddur, the structure will be the same, although there's going to be variations in words and the like. For example, in the Amidah, there are, differences in words, but the order of the brachot is the same in every rite that we have. So there is indeed a tremendous amount of uniformity. One should not overstate this. Yeah.
What year was it that the Siddur, as we know it, was?
Well, it's hard to say as we know it, because Rav Amram Gaon did not freeze with him him either. But Rav Amram Gaon's Siddur is around the 9th century. But again, as often happens, in the Middle Ages, even rabbis often felt that they could just add to the text of their predecessors to make corrections. So the problem is that Rav Amram Siddur, as it was reissued with all sorts of emendations, corrections, and revisions, which no longer reflected his original Siddur. Keep in mind as well that after Rav Amram Gaon, we entered the age of religious poetry, the Paitanim, which, added a whole bunch of extra things. For example, the Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur prayers, and special Shabbatot of Elazar HaKalir, and Svardim had other Paitanim, the Ibn Ezra. So although there's the basic prayers, but things like Slichot, keynotes on the 9th of Av, right, that whole genre was constantly expanded. The famous prayer of Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, in the Tana Tokef, right, that was added in the 11th century. Right. So there was a great, great expansion of liturgy in the next, after the time of the Gaonim. Yeah. Nusach just means the version, that's right. There's Nusach Ashkenaz, Nusach Svar, Nusach Edut HaMizrach, Nusach Taimani, Okay? Nusach Ari, which is of course much later, but the Ari basically consolidated different Nuscha'ot to determine what he thought was the best, etc. By the way, there is a, just to digress for a moment, there is a thought that the Ari, the great Kabbalist, expressed about the significance of the diversity of Nuscha'ot, of the versions of prayer. He related it to this idea. He says, which is right? I mean, do we assume, in fact, historians talk about this, do we assume that there was one standardized text and somehow, you know, in the course of time, people got it messed up? In other words, somebody's doing it wrong, or maybe everybody's doing it wrong, that there was the right way? Well, that's one way of looking at it, that there was a right way and it got changed over time. The other alternative was that the Talmud itself recognized that within a single structure, there could be multiple alternatives. The Ari relates it to even a deeper meaning. He points out that the Beit HaMikdash had 13 gates, and the tradition was each tribe had their own gate to the Beit HaMikdash, and if you didn't know your tribe, you went to the 13th gate. And therefore, he said, similarly, each tribe had its own unique prayer to God within the same structure, which in a mystical level, in ways we don't even perceive, reflects the nature of that tribe. And therefore, all of these different nuscha'ot are remnants of the ancient tribal prayers, which reflected the shama of that shevet. And the Ari said, in defense of his own nusach, it's called Nusach Ari, he is a Kohen. Now, it wouldn't be possible for me and a Kohen to have the same prayer. In other words, you know, if I'm just doing my thing, well, maybe I'm doing the right thing for my tribe. But if I'm doing the right thing for my tribe, he's not doing the right thing for his tribe. Unless, of course, it's Nusach Ari, in which is the 13th gate, that's going to work for both of us. So there are certain issues with the issue of, you know, each Nusach is correct, because it's according to your tribe, because we're not all from the same tribe, and certainly if one is a Kohen and one is not, we're Vadai, not from the same tribe. So those are issues. But be it as it may, Rav Amram Gaon, Rav Sadia Gaon, just some names just to be familiar with, Rav Shereira Gaon, now this is already towards the end of the Gaonim period. Rav Shereira Gaon is a very, very important, primarily because he wrote the document, which is called Igeret Rav Shereira Gaon, the letter of Rav Shereira Gaon, which sets out the definitive history of the composition of the Mishnah, the Gemara, and the history of the Gaonim in Babel up to his time. So, for example, all of the history that we talked about was primarily derived from the Igeret of Rav Shereira Gaon. And this was drawn from the archives. The yeshivot apparently actually kept detailed archives and histories of different personalities. And he did this in response to a question. See, everything the Gaonim did was in response to a question. Rav Amram Gaon compiled the Siddur in response to a question. So he was asked by a Jewish community, you know, we don't know the order of prayers. Can you instruct us? He sent them a Siddur, right? And that's the Siddur, right? But the Igeret Rav Shereira Gaon was a response to a question. Hey, what's the history of, you know, the Mishnah, the Gemara, and the Gaonim? He wrote the letter, right? He composed it. Of course, again, as is the problem, we have two different versions of the letter of Rav Shereira Gaon. Now, obviously, he did not write both of them, and the two versions have some significant distinctions in the historical narrative. There are also, as is always the case, since this predates printing, there are copying errors and manuscript discrepancies, and it's a very complicated document. It's not easy to understand either. It is available, by the way, even in an annotated English translation. So if you are interested in Talmudic history, you can get the Igeret Rav Shereira Gaon. Rav Shereira Gaon's son was the last of the Gaonim in Sura, and that is, his name is Hai, Rav Hai Gaon, an unusual name. And Rav Hai Gaon also was extraordinarily well known and great for his halachic prowess, but the Gaonic period is approximately 450 to 500 years. It ends relatively abruptly in the year 10,000. It's around the year 10. I'm sorry, the year 1,000 of the Common Era, or maybe it's around 10 or 20 years after that. And it ended essentially with the again as a result of the persecutions in Babylonia, which resulted in the great yeshiva of Sura being shut down, and that lasted for 800 years. Rav had founded Sura in around the year 200, and it closed after the death of Rav Hai Gaon in around the year 1000. So to this day, it is considered to be the longest consecutive yeshiva that ever existed in Jewish history for the entire 800-year period. There is a story that is recorded, which actually seems to be historically accurate, about, you know, there's a saying that God always gives us the refuah before the makah. That means before we get the illness, God gives us the cure. And as Chazal said in the Talmud, before one sun sets, another sun rises. And there is a story about four great rabbis from Babylonia who went on a fundraising mission. So apparently, even in those days, the Babylonian yeshivot also needed to collect money to run their operations. And as was unfortunately very common in those days, they were kidnapped and held for ransom. They were traveling to Europe. They were seized by pirates. And knowing that Jewish communities would pay ransom for captives, they would be held for expensive, exorbitant ransom. And they were ransomed in Spain, by Jews in Spain. And at that point, these four rabbis decided that they would make their home in Spain. And it is very interesting, because the next great Torah center for halakha, after the closing of the Babylonian yeshivot, happened to have been in Spain, and they were the genesis of this. And the tradition teaches us that they were actually brought to Spain shortly before the death of Rav Hai Gaon and the closing of the Babylonian yeshivot, as if to say God set into motion the process that would ensure the continuity of Jewish learning even before the Gaonim in Bavel were really, before there was decimated and destroyed.
The persecution in Babylonia, that Islamic, or
was
it the Mongols?
No, it was the Mongols. Again, we're still dealing, of course, at this point, keep in mind, we are beginning to see the rise of Islam. Islam is now becoming a force, and they, of course, will be a very, very powerful force in Jewish history. The Babylonian yeshivot, however, I believe were not closed. They were pre-Islamic in terms of their being closed out. And in Eretz Yisrael, the problem was primarily Christianity, not Islam. Now, be it as it may, though, therefore, in spite of the fact that the period of the Gaonim lasted for 500 years, and a lot of the figures are very well known, Rav Sadia Gaon, and a lot of them wrote books, but much of the period is shrouded with mystery. The details of the Babylonian history of the period are not entirely clear. Some of the circumstances surrounding the closure of Sura are not entirely clear, because it really happened like all of a sudden, basically. And the Gaonim's literature in Halakha is a bit scanty in the following sense. We do have works from the Gaonim in Bible, in Tanakh, with Sadia Gaon's commentaries. We do have some books in Jewish philosophy, also Rav Sadia Gaon and Munot V'Deot. And we do have what are called tshuvot haga'onim, responsa, in which questions would be submitted to the academies. The academies would debate them, and they would formulate answers. But it's very interesting that the tshuvot haga'onim tend to be very, very short. Somebody would ask a question, is this allowed or not allowed? And they would just say, asur, mutar. Their authority was such that they didn't necessarily give a tremendous amount of reasoning. They just said, this is the law. And they gave responses, etc., which were accepted as law in many, many cases, but a lot of the background and the analysis was not fully presented. Now, after the Gaonim, we enter a new stage. And again, these stages to some degree are arbitrary, but basically, at least in retrospect, the death of Rav Hai Gaon ushers in a new era. both geographically, because Babylonia is no longer going to be a major source of halakha, and spiritually, and this is called the age of the Rishonim. Of course, they didn't call themselves Rishonim, because just like those who experienced World War I did not call it World War I, because they didn't know there would be a World War II. Rishonim means the earlier generations. See, it's a little confusing, because you would figure the earlier generations should be the earlier generations. Not really. The earlier generations are those who are after the Tanoim, after the Amoraim, after the Gaonim. We then come to the earlier generations. The only reason they're called the earlier generations is because they're earlier than the later generations who come later. But basically, they are post-Gaonim authorities. Among these are Maimonides, as we'll see, etc. And where this brings us, in other words, is to an age that we might call, besides the age of the Rishonim, Rashi, right? All those people are the great medieval commentators. This lasts from the year 1000 to approximately the Spanish Inquisition, the Spanish expulsion in 1492. So you're dealing with almost a 500-year period of these are the great commentaries on the Talmud and the like. We talked about Rashi, we talked about the Tosafot, etc. But the topic I really want to talk about tonight, and probably next week as well, is the concept of codification. Because above all, well, I shouldn't say above all, but perhaps the dominant factor that emerged in this area of halachic judgment is the concept of codification, which really continues the work of the Gaonim to try to standardize and uniform, create a uniform halacha. And why is there this press towards codification? Part of it, as I indicated, was the rise of Karaitism. Part of it is, as Jews are getting geographically more dispersed, it was thought that a uniformity of religious observance will create a greater sense of unity. Part of it is the idea that there was a feeling that fewer and fewer people were capable, even rabbis, of mastering the Talmud and coming to independent judgments. So they needed to be told what to do. But there is a built-in contradiction in the codification movement. And that is, who created the authority to codify? You know, it's one thing when you had a universally regarded centralized institution, whether it be the Sanhedrin, which the Torah itself says we must accept as definitive, or whether it be the two yeshivot in Bavel, which were voluntarily accepted as definitive. So their authority came because you had that institution. But keep in mind that after the destruction of the yeshiva in Surah, there more or less was the end of any centralized leadership position. So you're embedded in a self-contradiction. How do you codify and impose central instruction when you don't have a centralized institution that has the authority? Just to give you an example, to get a little ahead of myself, Maimonides on his own codified Jewish law. That's fine. But why would anybody have to listen to Maimonides' codification of Jewish law? Maimonides had no position other than he happened to be the rabbi of he had a number of positions. He was the physician to the Sultan in Cairo, but that did not give his halachic decisions any particular weight. He was the rabbi of a small synagogue in Cairo, so I suppose that would give him authority over his congregants. But what, somebody writes a book and says, this is the halakha. What makes it the halakha?
People accept it.
Well, yeah, so correct. So ultimately, one has to understand that after the demise of the centralization of the Gaonim, the concept of codification proceeds exclusively on the basis of voluntary acceptance, based on the community's esteem and admiration for the greatness and scholarship and saintliness of the author. Meaning it's totally a voluntary point at this point, because there's no halachic reason that one would accept Maimonides' rule for anything other than he's Maimonides. In other words, there was no institutional framework that gave him any authority over anybody. Okay. So this is the paradox that one should be aware of, that the age of the Rishonim is on one level the age of decentralization, different communities of halachic scholarship. Some were in Western Europe, concentrated in Spain, in France and Germany, with some in Italy. There were communities in North Africa, in Morocco, etc. So on one end you have great decentralization, and at the same time you have a push for attempts to create codification and uniformity. On balance, we have to say that although the period of the Rishonim did produce the great works of codification, particularly Maimonides' Code, the Tor, which I'll talk about, and even the Shulchan Aruch, which is the tail end of the period of the Rishonim, the great works of codification were produced, but they did not at all establish a uniformity of practice, because in point of fact, every time you try to, it's a moving target, every time you try to freeze the halakhic determination, there are always new issues that come up, new opinions, new views. Even the Shulchan Aruch, we talk about the Shulchan Aruch is the definitive code. But open up the page of Shulchan Aruch and mm-hmm. see how many commentaries are on it. There are so many commentaries you would need a magnifying glass. I mean, you have to get 100 commentaries on the page. Obviously the print is very tiny. You know, so the point is, yes, the Shulchan Aruch is the definitive code of Jewish law, but the commentaries give us, you know, again, hundreds of views on different issues. So we have to say that the period of the Rishonim did produce the great codes, but the great codes did not accomplish what they wanted to accomplish. They become a new reference point for the continued debate over and over and over again. So we're dealing with this 500-year period, the period of the Rishonim. Remember, you have these different Torah centers, Spain, France, Germany, Italy, North Africa, not too much in the land of Israel at this point, although towards the end of this period there is a renaissance in Eretz Israel, again, particularly after the expulsion of the Jews from Spain. Just to give you some names so you have a sense of who are these, remember we're dealing with a pretty long period, Rashi, which is the acronym for Rav Shlomo ben Yitzchak, was in France writing his great commentaries on the Bible and on the Talmud. We have Maimonides in Spain. We have Nachmanides in Spain. We have Moshe Ben. Maimonides was first in Spain. Then he was in Egypt. Nachmanides was in Spain. We have Rav Shlomo Ben Aderet, who is called the Rashba, who was the disciple of Nachmanides, etc. Right, so these are very, very famous names in the annals of advanced study of Jewish law. But in terms of codification, I just want to mention three for tonight, because again, we can mention probably 20 or 30, but at some point there would be diminishing returns. I just want to focus on three because they are so pivotal in the history of halakhic codification. The first is a work that may not impress people at first glance because it just seems to be summarizing the Talmud, but it is a work of absolutely surpassing importance, and people don't always realize how important it is. And this is the code of the Alfasi. And let me introduce this person who's not that well known to many people. His abbreviation is RIF. RIF stands for Rav Yitzchak Pasi, which means Rav Yitzchak of Fez. Fez is Morocco. He is often called Alfasi, which is just the Arabic Alfasi. Rav Alfasi was born in 1013. Shortly toward the end of the period of the Gaonim. He studied in North Africa, and he eventually lived in Fez, and towards the end of his life, he moved to Spain. What the RIF did is the following. The RIF, we call him the RIF, Rav Yitzchak Alfasi, what he did was, he essentially summarized the Talmud, and he indicated which view in the Talmud should be regarded as halakha. Now, if you open a volume of Talmud, remember we looked at the page of Talmud the other day, so you have the text in the middle with commentaries on the side. If you go to the back of a volume of Talmud, you'll see something that looks exactly like a Talmud. It's that column of solid print in the middle surrounded by commentaries, but it's not. It's riff. Now, just to give you an example. If a Talmudic tractate, let's say, may have 80 pages, 80, you know, double-sided pages, so the riff on that masechet may only be 15 pages. What does the riff do? Typically, when the Talmud quotes a Mishnah, the Talmud will go through questions and answers and debates and discussions, proofs and refutations and counterproofs and refutations, and give you a multiplicity of views after a lot of discussion. What the Rif does is, the Rif quotes the Mishnah, the Rif indicates the two opinions in the Talmud and eliminates the questions, answers, refutations, but he does present the views, and then indicates which view is to be followed and tells you why. So, typically, therefore, the Rif may take a Talmudic discussion that may go on for 10 pages, and the Rif reduces it to 2 pages. Now, you see what the Rif is doing, though. The Rif is not just giving you a final rule like Maimonides. The Rif gives you the views that are presented in the Talmud, but without all of the proofs and argumentation, and then indicates which view is to be followed. So the Rif's work is often called Talmud Katan or Talmud Katsar. It's often called the abbreviation of the Talmud, etc. But his own title was Sefer Halachot. It was the book of Halachot or Hilchot HaRif, the laws of the Rif. Now, one thing, the Rif only did this abridgment for those portions of the Talmud that are still relevant today in the diaspora when we don't have a temple. So, for example, the Rif did not do an abridgment for the order of the sacrifices and the like, because that doesn't, because we don't have the temple, so those laws don't apply today. Although the Chafetz Chaim, of all people, much, much later, in the 19th century, the Chafetz Chaim, in fact, did the equivalent of a Rif on the order of Seder Kodshim. Now, the Rif, therefore, really serves two distinct functions. One function is to abbreviate the Talmudic discussion so you can kind of get an overview of what the Talmud is saying without having to go through the entire process. That's one thing that he did. The second thing that he did was he indicated which view is to be followed in matters of halakha. Now again, you could raise the question, who gave him the right to make that decision? The answer is nobody gave him the right. He just indicated what his view was, but his view has had an enormous impact on halakha. Maimonides, with all the ingenuity and inventiveness and creativity he brought to his code, in terms of actual halachic decisions, Maimonides' code is based 95% on the decisions of the Rif. So the Rif, in terms of deciding which of the many views in the Talmud are to be followed, is enormous. His influence is absolutely enormous, because he almost single-handedly laid down the rules. Now, of course, the Rif also used the word, the Gaonim and the like, but the Rif also made many independent judgments. He did not always follow the predecessor decisions of the Gaonim. So the Rif's work on the history of Halakha cannot be underestimated. It was an enormously important work because it was the basis of Maimonides' code, which in turn is the basis of the Shulchan Aruch, etc. Now, how did the Rif decide? Did the Rif flip a coin? Like, I mean, there's a Talmudic discussion of many opinions, and the Rif will summarize the two opinions, or the five opinions, and say, and the law is in accordance with this opinion. Like, who told him? Well, we talked about this a few weeks ago. Generally speaking, the Rif derived his rules from the structural text of the Talmud itself. So, for example, I had mentioned, often the Rif would invoke rules in the Talmud itself. The Talmud might say, an argument between Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel, the rule is Beit Hillel. An argument between Rav and Shmuel, the Talmud lays down the rule that in monetary affairs, Shmuel was the greater expert. Right? So, these are rules of decision that are in the Talmudic text itself. And when that's what you have, it's fairly easy for the Rif to say, I'm following the rules laid down in the Talmud itself for the resolution of machlokot. Often, it's not so easy. Often what the RIF does is the RIF has to analyze the give and take of a discussion and conclude, well, it's apparent that one position has 10 questions on it that have very difficult answers, and the other position has fewer questions. So that may indicate this is a better position because there are fewer problems that are connected to it. Right? It's a very close answer. Or often what the RIF does is the RIF will say that even though tractate Gittin indicates there are 5 opinions, but there's another tractate that only uses 1 of those opinions, which indicates elsewhere that 1 opinion is more dominant. In other words, there are what you might call textual clues or sleuthing or detective work in trying to figure out what is a dominant view. And a lot of this spade work, so to speak, was done by the RIF in the Hilchot HaRIF. So remember, if you ever study Talmud from an authentic, from a regular official volume of Talmud, be sure that you're looking at the Talmud and not the RIF. I remember when I began to study Talmud years ago, because you open up a Talmud, if you just turn too far to the back, you're looking at something that looks exactly like a Gemara, but it actually is Al-Fasi. It is the code of Al-Fasi. So the point I want to make is that people think, what did the RIF do? The RIF just, took the Gemara. In fact, it's not even written in his own language. Basically, when he summarizes the Talmud, he uses the exact words of the Talmud. In other words, he'll quote the positions, rip out all the intervening discussion, right? So a lot of the RIF is not even anything he wrote. It's simply exact quotations. So people say, what did the RIF do? I mean, he just is just pulling out quotes. The RIF did an enormously important work in terms of laying down the foundations for deriving halakha from the Talmud. And this is the code of Al-Fasi, and again, he had no particular institutional authority to do this, he just did it. And because of his great prestige and towering stature, his words were accepted as very, very definitive. Now, there is, however, a problem in the code of Al-Fasi. By the way, very occasionally, the RIF did not, the RIF's code is not a commentary on the Talmud. He doesn't explain Talmudic passages. He kind of quotes them verbatim and then indicates which is to be followed. But occasionally, when there's some confusion what a passage means, the RIF will offer some commentary on it as well. And sometimes those commentaries are actually written in Arabic. So the Hilchot HaRIF is written in the language of the Talmud, Hebrew, Aramaic, but then sometimes the RIF will give you a long Arabic explanation of a very complicated passage. In the standard editions, the Arabic has been translated into Hebrew, so we can see that as well. But again, it's still very astounding how a single person could have assumed, in a way, this was a greater or more remarkable achievement than even Maimonides, because the RIF was kind of the first one that did this, and it was so universally accepted. Okay? Yeah. Well, again, I don't want to speak disrespectfully about such a great authority, but in a positive way, it was an act of chutzpah that one should be able to go directly into the Talmud and just tell you which opinion is to be followed and why. But he always gave reasons. And again, the thing about the RIF's code is it is very, very tied to the Talmudic text. He presents all of the views in the Talmud without the give and take and the proofs, and then he indicates which one is to be followed, unlike Maimonides that only gives you the final view without indicating all of the different alternatives. So it was actually very popular. It's not done that much today in advanced yeshivot, but for many, many years in the yeshivot of Europe, the custom was that for half the year they would study the Talmudic tractates with all of the debates and the argumentation, and for the other half year they would review by studying the RIF. The RIF is actually a very good way of reviewing Talmud because the RIF summarizes every Talmudic discussion. So it's very hard to remember every, the intricate discussion, but the RIF kind of gives you an outline as well as giving you a final halakha. But again, as I say, the RIF only wrote on approximately half of the Talmud. He didn't write on the order of Korbanot, etc., and the various other things. Now, there is one particular disadvantage in the RIF's code. That is, The Rif follows the order of the Babylonian Talmud. By that I mean the following. Let's take any you can take any tractate in the Talmud at all. Take tractate Shabbat. Now, tractate Shabbat is about the laws of Shabbat. However, in the course of Talmudic discussion, because the Talmud is always drawing, particularly the Gemara is always drawing analogies from all sorts of areas. In a given discussion of Shabbat, there'll be references to kashrut, and references to purity, and references to divorce, because it all comes in. Well, the Rif follows the order of the Talmud. If in the middle of tractate Shabbat, there's a discussion about divorce, the Rif will mention the law of divorce there, although he will tend to bring in the relevant cross-references to Gittin. In other words, he'll bring it in. He won't leave them apart, but he will bring the halachot in the context in which they are discussed in the Talmud. Now, you can understand that that's a little difficult, meaning to say the following. If I wanted to learn all of the laws of Jewish divorce, how would I know where to look in Alfasi's code? Now, obviously, I would get a lot of laws by learning the tractate on Gittin, but I wouldn't get them all, because there might be something in fact, unless I learn the whole thing, I'm not sure if I'm getting anything. You see? So this was a problem in the Alfasi's code. Now, on one hand, he very much did not want to write a freestanding code. He wanted his code to emerge from the depths of the Talmud itself. He very much wanted it to be connected to the Talmud. But on the other hand, that itself creates a tremendous disadvantage, because the Talmud discusses many, many areas in many, many different places. Okay? Now, this was remedied to some degree later by the construction of indexes and the like, in other words, in which the laws of the Rif are organized topically, etc. But that's later, that's even post-Maimonides, etc. But the Rif's code itself did not have an index, and therefore that was its great disadvantage in terms of understanding halakha. By the way, commentaries were written on the Rif's code. Right, the Rif, you know, although the Rif's prestige was enormous, but not everybody agreed. There were Rishonim who did not agree with the Rif's decisions in halachic matters. I'll just mention some of them. The great commentator who so often had the temerity to disagree with the Rif, and it was temerity, as you'll discover, was a very independent thinker who lived in France, Rav Zerachia Halevi. Rav Zerachia Halevi wrote a commentary at the age of 17, which he called HaMa'or, the Book of Enlightenment. In the order of Moed, on the holidays, he called it Mor HaKatan, the small light, because the Rif in Moed is relatively shorter. That's borrowed from the biblical term. The moon is called the small light, and the sun is called the big light. On Nashim and Nezikin, he called it Mor HaGadol. And Rav Zerachia Halevi is often referred to as the Raza, but he's also called the Baal HaMa'or, the author of Ma'or. And he was very young. The Rif was already dead. And the Rif's prestige was enormous. And here you have a 17-year-old adolescent who basically tries to argue from the Talmud that the Rif is wrong. So one could imagine that the Baal HaMa'or was sometimes attacked on an ad hominem basis for the effrontery of daring to challenge the Rif.